From the Sky News Centre at 6, a concrete mixer lorry has crashed off a bridge and onto the roof of a passenger train, injuring 8 people. The lorry driver was trapped in the wreckage of his vehicle after the incident on a branch line near to Oxshott in Surrey. It's understood around 40 people were on board the South West Trains Guildford to London Waterloo service when the accident happened at around about 3 o'clock. Local radio reporter Saffron De Silva is on the road bridge above the scene.
I should be looking at a 4-foot-high brick wall, and it's just rubble. I can't see the wreckage because it is quite a big drop, actually. We're talking a good sort of 20, 30 metres. Luckily, it came down in between carriages.
Former Immigration Minister Phil Willis has lost his Commons seat and been suspended from the Labour Party over his general election campaign. A special court has ruled that he lied about a Lib Dem rival and stirred up racial tensions in his Oldham East and Saddleworth constituency. Mr Willis is challenging the decision. Labour's deputy leader, Harriet Harman, condemns his actions.
It's no part of Labour's politics to try and win elections by saying things that aren't true. And because of the findings of fact by this court, Phil Willis has been suspended from the Labour Party.
Radical preacher Abu Hamza has won his appeal against the government's attempts to strip him of his British passport. The cleric, who's serving 7 years for inciting murder and race hate, is in Belmarsh prison while he also challenges attempts to extradite him to the US. NASA has postponed its final ever launch of the space shuttle Discovery until at least next month. It's after engineers found a hydrogen leak in its external fuel tank. Lily Allen has thanked fans on Twitter for their support after losing her baby just a few days ago. The singer was 6 months pregnant but lost the baby last weekend following complications. And Michael Jackson is being tipped as a challenger to Take That for the Christmas number one album. A new collection of the late star's songs, entitled Michael, will go on sale on December the 13th. That's the latest. I'm Chris Sharp.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
BCFM Travel News. In association with the Global Traffic Network, supported by the Highways Agency.
On the westbound M4 going towards Bristol, traffic is slow from junctions 18 to 19. That's the A46 turning for Bath and the M32 junction. There was an accident along that stretch, though all lanes are back open now. Further west, it's queuing between junctions 19 and 20. That's the M32 and the M5. And the eastbound M4 past Bristol is slow from just after junction 21, the M48 merge, all the way through towards the M32 interchange at junction 19. Not helped by an earlier accident on the exit slip road at junction 19. That's affecting the M32 coming out of Bristol, which is slow from before junction 1 at Hambrook out towards the M4. The northbound M5 going past Bristol is queuing from before junction 17 at Cribbs Causeway up towards the M4 interchange. And the southbound M5 going from Bristol into Somerset is queuing from around junction 18 at Avonmouth across the Avonmouth Bridge and as far as junction 21 at Weston-super-Mare. In Dorset, the eastbound A35 Dorchester bypass looking slow at the Monkey's Jump roundabout. That's the A37 junction. And on the Devon-Cornwall border, the A38 Tamar Bridge is busy but moving in both directions. Also, if using the A417 in Gloucestershire, going north from Cirencester up to the Air Balloon roundabout, beware of stop-start traffic, not helped by wet and foggy conditions. And the M4 going west into South Wales, that's stop-start for 5 miles now from junction 23A at Magor Services, just after the second Severn crossing, through towards the Bringlass Tunnels in Newport. I'm Chris Wood.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Coming up, there have been calls for a radical shake-up in the banking system by the new city regulator Mervyn King, Governor of the Bank of England. About time too, I hear you say. And we hear also from the wife of a colonel in the United States Marine Corps that Muslim terrorists may not be all they seem. Also, increasing numbers of parents and children are choosing to educate their children at home in Bristol, despite scare stories that it's illegal. We asked, does home education really provide a viable alternative to regular schools? But first, who are the Tea Party and what will the Republican majorities in this week's US elections mean for us here in the UK? Martin, by way of introduction, can you give us your take on exactly what this Tea Party movement is really all about? I know it comes from the Boston Tea Party, which is when the American War of Independence against the British colonial powers started.
Yeah, the Boston Tea Party was when political activists who were opposed to British rule in America, dressed up as Indians, got onto a ship in Boston Harbor and threw all the tea into the harbor because they didn't want to pay stamp duty, basically British taxes. It was a protest against British taxes. So the Tea Party movement takes its inspiration from this event in the 18th century.
Is this the idea that they don't like paying any taxes?
Or? Well, it's a kind of anti-tax philosophy underlying it. It's actually a very varied movement. There's all sorts of different ideas floating around in the so-called Tea Party movement. One of the things that people don't realise is that it's largely what we call an astroturf movement. That is to say, it looks as if it's being led by local people who are very much from ordinary folk. But in actual fact, looking into the finances of the Tea Party, you'll see that it's multi-billionaires who've actually provided most of the resources for this Tea Party phenomenon.
Well, Texas talk show host Alex Jones is an outspoken critic of the American government who doesn't pull his punches. So let's have a listen now to his take on the outcome of this week's midterm elections, heard earlier this week on Russia Today.
There's been a major political realignment. The Real Tea Party, founded back in 2007 by Ron Paul and other real patriots, who are conservative fiscally but are also anti-war, pro-Bill of Rights and Constitution, that's the Real Tea Party. And Senator DeMint has written an article in the Wall Street Journal today, talking about high-powered Republican lobbyists saying, we're going to go in, we're going to bribe them, we're going to pay them off. And so it's an oversimplification to say that the entire Tea Party is financed by News Corp and the Koch brothers. But it's true that they've attempted to co-opt it and control it. And many Republicans like Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, they have taken on its mantle, even though when you get down to their real actions, they are in the hip pocket of the global corporations. But more than just having one group of corporations behind Republicans and another group behind Democrats, they just hedge their bets. In fact, most of these corporations are financing all of the groups so that they're beholden to them and so that they can control them. But this is the biggest landslide for one party in over 70 years, 65 seats in the House, 8 seats or 7 seats in the Senate, 10 governors flipping to Republican, legislatures. Just like people went out in droves for Obama wanting change, they're desperate. They're hitting the reset button. Now they've gone out in droves for the Republicans, and if they don't deliver, they're going to be out. And so what we see is the public really waking up to the puppet masters and understanding the biggest group above all the other corporations in the Fortune 100 is the major 6 mega banks of the private Federal Reserve who literally control the issuance of currency and credit. That's the big group that's over all of this, and that's why you saw Republicans in the primary, the establishment, go after Rand Paul, was because he actually wants to audit it and abolish it like his father, Dr. Ron Paul.
So do you think that, we talked about the changes just now. Do you think they're actually going to affect President Obama's agenda? Will these guys be able to accomplish what they said they were going to when they were campaigning?
Well, that remains to be seen. You've got the Republican insiders trying to co-opt the Tea Party and any opposition. You've got the media painting all opposition as only being the Tea Party when people are upset across the board and unemployment's off the charts and the economy's shutting down. So the question is, will Obama, teamed up with Republican insiders, be able to continue business as usual? I mean, they fight with each other, but only over the reins of power. And I think they're going to have a lot of trouble doing it. I think that this is the beginning of the end of these special corporate interests that have been sucking the federal purse dry through corporate welfare. And I believe that this Tea Party movement is the best opposition in the last 75 years, the most bona fide, the most authentic. That doesn't mean it's not infiltrated, and it doesn't mean that it's being more and more infiltrated. It's just it signifies issues like the Federal Reserve being private and needs to be abolished, issues like controlling our borders, issues like repealing anti-Second Amendment legislation. These things are becoming more and more mainstream. When Ron Paul won the CPAC Republican straw poll that's coveted, the media tried to ignore it, but that was mainline Republicans, the most powerful in the country, voting for him. And he talks about the CIA shipping drugs into the country and how we need to end all these wars and abolish the Federal Reserve. And so there's a huge awakening conduited through mainline conservatives who were waking up, and the Rupert Murdochs, who would say you were a conspiracy theorist right. if you talked about world government a few years ago, they've capitulated. And so to stay relevant, they're now having to admit that all of this is real right. as an attempt to politically camouflage themselves. So the beginning of the end of the globalists is here. As Zbigniew Brzezinski said 4 months ago, he said, for the first time in history, humanity is awake and staring at the elite, not the puppets.
That's Alex Jones there, US Texas-based talk show host, talking on the Russian English language satellite channel, Russia Today, earlier this week. Now, Martin, he's saying a lot of stuff there, but he says it's the end of corporate interests. Do you really think that?
I don't think so. I mean, Alex Jones is... I appreciate what Alex Jones is saying there. I think Ron Paul in particular is a very interesting politician, and he was the initiator of this Tea Party movement some years ago. He is a conservative, small government conservative, but he also, as a small government conservative, is against war. He's against big. He's against the corporate state, and I think he and Denis Kucinich, who is on the left wing of the Democratic Party, who put forward a joint resolution to audit the Federal Reserve. So, a rather interesting development in U.S. politics is this rapprochement between the radical right and the radical left, who are both opposed to the mainstream system. But I'm afraid the Tea Party, Alex Jones is a bit too far to the right for my views. The Tea Party is actually a know-nothing party. There used to be a party in the United States in the 19th century called the Know-Nothings. The Tea Party are a reincarnation of them.
So, I mean, what he's saying there essentially is that it started off in the right direction, this Tea Party thing, but he said it actually used the word infiltrated.
Yeah, well, I don't think it even started off in the right direction. The idea that government is the problem and all we've got to do is get the government off our backs is just simplistic. The real world requires a complex, nuanced approach to these things, and it's just far... You know, people like simple ideas because they're simple, but the problem with simple ideas is that they're often wrong.
Now, how do you think this is all going to play out then over the next few months in US policy, particularly foreign policy?
Well, the real problem is a lot of these Tea Party people are very, very pro-Israel, and Israel is champing at the bit for a war with Iran. They've now got a green light. Potentially for
are they
war.
Connected then with these Christian Zionists, the Christian right?
Well, the Tea Party the people in theory are supposedly only interested in big government and taxes and so on and deficit reduction, although they're not going to reduce the deficit by their policies, they're going to increase the deficit, but that's another economic argument which you can leave aside. A lot of them, the Tea Party movement is very inchoate. It's got lots and lots of different fractions within it. Most of these people, I'm afraid, are even more pro-Israel than the previous set of Republican politicians. And that is, the Israelis are happy with this. They think that they're going to be able to push Obama into a war with Iran now, and that's what they'll be looking for.
Right. Well, Marina Morris is joining me now, and you have, I think, a report today, Marina, on longevity, as we've heard that the world's oldest person died yesterday, aged 114.
Yes. Hello. The French nun Edjian Blandon, previously certified as the world's oldest person, died yesterday at age 114 on the French Caribbean island on Saint Barthélemy. She became a Catholic nun at the age of 24 and was known for giving out sweets to children to encourage them to attend Bible reading. Her nephew said she lived so long because she decided to give her virginity to God. She was French and still enjoyed a glass of champagne on her birthday. The oldest human being on the record was also a French woman. Genius Louise Calment died in 1997 at the age of 122 years. She smoked from the age of 21 until 117, although she attributed her long life to olive oil, port wine and chocolate. Current projection from the Cambridge University Group of the History of Population and Social Structure are that a typical French female baby born now has a 50% chance of reaching the age of 100. The oldest woman now alive is from United States and is also 114 years old. Is extreme longevity a gift from a god? Or is it a balanced lifestyle? Or being born in the right country? Or personality, motivation, or chance? Are these even meaningful questions. There is another area of question: what is important for us? How we spend our lives or how we die? A recent survey by the Dying Matters Coalition revealed that nearly two-thirds, 61% of respondents think the English are more reserved about death than other nationalities. And 3 out of 4 of respondents in England do not spend time remembering loved one who had died. Experts say that by ignoring imminent death, we are denying ourselves the time to prepare for our death and say our goodbyes. The purpose of this debate is to encourage people to plan the death and funeral they want. It may be time to encourage people to consciously take responsibility for their life's journey and open a new debate by asking a question. Will you regret missed chances and opportunities on the final day of your life?
Marina, thanks very much. And I wonder, Martin, if some of what Marina's talking about there, it relates to the story we were discussing earlier about the BBC pensions dispute, because obviously there is a demographic time bomb. People are getting older and older and older, and this is going to lead to potentially to pension pots just simply not being big enough, despite the financial crisis.
Yeah, I mean, this demographic time bomb thing, I think, is a red herring. As one of the correspondents...
So it's not a time bomb at all?
No. Well, it's a red herring, because as one of the respondents to Marina's earlier Vox Pops was saying, the real issue is that the gap between rich and poor is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that means that there isn't enough money to pay for the poor's, the poorer people's healthcare, for their pensions and so on. But that's not to do with a demographic time bomb. It's to do with inequality of income and wealth. I understand that the place in the world where people live longest is Okinawa in Japan. Sometimes people live longer for genetic reasons. There's a valley in Georgia where everybody's related genetically and they live for quite a long time. But in Okinawa, it's to do with lifestyle. And they have a very, very healthy lifestyle in Okinawa. They eat a lot of vegetables. I understand that if people visit there and they look as if they're not had enough to eat, people leave vegetables on their doorstep to make sure that they get their vegetables to eat.
Now, for some strange reason, a lot of English people seem to almost take pride in not eating their vegetables, don't they?
Well, when Britain has not got a very good record on longevity. I mean, we are living longer now, but often the quality of life of the last few years of life is not that good. I mean, dementia, of course, is becoming a big problem because people are physically alive, but their brains are no longer capable of functioning, and that can be very distressing for everybody, including their relatives.
So how does this all relate then to the financial crisis, the longevity?
Well, I mean, as happened in the collapse of the Soviet Union, the death rate went through the roof during that period. I mean, there was already a fairly poor lifestyle and diet and so on, and fairly limited lifespan. But the introduction of capitalist economic relations in the Soviet Union saw a big increase in the death rate. And basically, the attitude seemed to be at the time that the sooner these people are dead, the better, because they're costing us money. Ultimately, the purpose of the economy is to look after the people. We're not here to serve the economy. The economy is there to serve us. And actually, we've invented lots of clever machines to do all the work for us, so that we should have longer period of pension at the end of our lives, and we should have more holidays. We were talking about the French and their strikes the other week about pensions. It's an issue, isn't it? I mean, the French could be richer, but they choose to be poorer and have longer holidays and bigger pensions. We've got to start thinking about what sort of society we really want, rather than saying, oh, we can't afford this and we can't afford that. We need to actually decide where we want to go and have a plan to get there. And I think we didn't really cover this in the first hour, but cutting public expenditure is not going to reduce the deficit. It's going to crash the economy and increase the deficit. And we need to actually start thinking, hang on, we need to build an infrastructure, human and physical, for the future, and we need to make a plan to do that now.
And also, of course, reform the financial system.
Indeed.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, every week on Freeview cable and satellite channel Russia Today, former New York stockbroker Max Keiser and his co-host Stacey Herbert pull apart the world's financial headlines. This week, they picked up on a groundbreaking speech made by Bank of England Governor Mervyn King.
Well, and then the final headline goes to the heart of this whole fabric.
Get to the heart of it.
Of corruption.
Take us to the heart of it, Stacey.
Bank of England head Mervyn King proposes eliminating fractional reserve banking.
What?
So this... Exactly.
What?
So this was at the Buttonwood Conference in New York just recently. And Mervyn King said, eliminating fractional reserve banking explicitly recognizes that the pretense that risk-free deposits can be supported by risk assets is alchemy. If there is a need for genuinely safe deposits, the only way they can be provided while ensuring costs and benefits are fully aligned is to insist such deposits do not coexist with risky assets.
It's pure alchemy. The whole phantasmagorical nonsense called the fractional reserve banking model supported by fiat currency and phantom judges adds up to one big goose egg. And it's lorded over by phantom judges with no authority. Anyone who's being victimized by these austerity measures has the option at this moment to opt out. Don't pay the credit card debt. Don't pay the mortgage debt. Don't pay any of these debts because they were fraudulently induced and no one with authority is trying to impose them upon you. And the only reason you would pay any of these debts is because you're a glutton for self-punishment.
Well, and of course, finally on that, I'll say, Max, that we've been talking about fake judges and you could say the head of the central banks have been fake judges because they've been operating since the 1970s under this pretense that they provide a gold standard. And now we've found out that actually they are a fake gold standard. They are not a real gold standard as we see with this ever-increasing amounts of quantitative easing and money being printed into the economy.
Mervyn King, the ghost of Christmas future, rattling around central banks. Stacey Herbert, thanks so much for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thank you, Max.
Yes, Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert there from the Kaiser Report off of the satellite channel Russia Today. Now, Martin, fractional reserve banking, if Mervyn King is actually talking about bringing into it, what does that really mean?
Well, I haven't seen Mervyn King's remarks, so it's very hard.
He made them in New York, and they were actually reported also by Robert Peston.
Well, I'm sorry, I haven't picked up on that this week. I mean, I think what's beginning to happen is people are beginning to ask the big questions about how the banking system operates. Most people presume that they knew what they were doing and just leave them to it. But now, of course, people are beginning to ask the serious questions about how does it actually operate? Who is in charge? How is it all supposed to work? And it's about time that we ask these questions because the financial system, the deregulated financial system, has become like a cancerous tumour on the body of human society. If we don't do something to reform it, it's going to kill us. And that's how serious it is.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, are all the bomb attacks in Iraq and Afghanistan being carried out by Muslim fanatics, or are many of them being done by our allies or our own special forces under orders from MI6, CIA, NATO intelligence in Brussels? Well, one person who believes they are is the former wife of United States Marine Corps Colonel George Griggs. Her name is Kay Griggs. And she should know.
The Israelis train with the SEALs. They do a lot of wet ops murders over here because of some sort of arrangement. The young boys, I met three young assassins on a bus going up back and forth to Sarah as I went on the bus because they were sabotaging my car so often. So I sat next to two young assassins, one from Romania, one from Haiti. And I let them know that I understand, you know, how it is. And this little boy cried. I won't mention which one it was because it may get back to him. But he told me it was the same scenario. His mother, he lives on $850 a month. Now, these are mercenaries working. The taxpayers are paying mercenaries. The taxpayers are paying young men who are not citizens of the United States to kill innocent people, women and children. They get on a flight from Norfolk and Oceania. Mm-hmm. They fly to Stuttgart, and I was told this. This is what they do. Then they go by a special helicopter to countries like Turkey, like the part of Iraq, to Algeria, to parts of Africa, and they do wet ops. They'll just, you know, murder 5, 10, 20 people, and then they blame it on the Arabs, or they blame it on somebody else, but it's actually NATO rogue assassins.
Okay, Griggs there, former wife of United States Marine Corps Colonel George Griggs. And you can see a fascinating extended interview with Kay, whether you agree with her or not, on the internet, which runs for about 2 hours. Now, Martin, do you think this is credible? Because after all, she was married to a colonel in the United States Marine Corps.
Well, I don't know how credible she is as a person or whatever, but the idea that NATO secret services are involved in assassinations and terrorism is already proven. I mean, we know that this is the case. We've covered this on many times on this show. The Gladio network in Western Europe was involved in all sorts of terrorist actions in the 60s, 70s and 80s, including the Bologna bombing, the Brabant massacres, the bombings of a beer festival in Munich, parliamentary investigations in Belgium, Italy and Switzerland have proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that Western intelligence services are carrying out terrorist actions, or they were then, and nobody's ever been punished for these actions, so we can presume that they probably still are. And so in Pakistan, for example, senior Pakistani military figures have been saying over the last few months that many of the bomb attacks in Pakistan are being orchestrated either by the Americans or by the Indians or by the Israelis. And so that when we see like these two packages arriving in planes, which may or may not have been bombs, we don't know who planted those packages. It could be our own intelligence services, which is why we should have police primacy in investigating these things, which is what I was stressing earlier. The only way to get to the bottom of this is to have independent police investigation of what's going on. And if the intelligence services or the secret services are involved, then they should be punished. It's got to happen.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, increasing numbers of parents and children are choosing to educate their children at home in Bristol, despite scare stories that it is illegal. Well, we ask now, does home education really provide a viable alternative to regular schools? I asked Cherry Townsend, who has two children who have been home educated, why she decided to take them out of school and how they were getting on this summer going back to normal school for the first time.
I'm Cherry, three girls, twins are now 13 and Drew's 5. And my girls went to badminton school for a couple of years, and then due to a separation, we thought we'd give it a go home educating, simply because to go into private school and then state school, I personally thought they would get bullied, even though you've met them and they are quite resilient children. It's just another option that was open to us.
So why did you finally choose to do that rather than to send them to a state school?
Well, we had a look at the state school, but where they were so... They were left alone. They were quite independent in badminton. They were allowed to do their own things, go to the library, get their own books out. It was very much that they're given responsibility, whereas in the schools in Long Ashton where we live, though they are very good, didn't seem to be able to cater for that. But they were really good schools there. We were blessed that the schools within reach were good, but just not really for them.
But it's a big decision, isn't it? Because the children almost expect to be being educated alongside their neighbours around where they live and to see those children when they come back from school?
Not necessarily, because when they're at badminton, unfortunately we didn't live next to all those lovely big houses that the other children did live in. But no, not really. And a lot of the other children, there are a versatile range of children that go to a versatile range of schools. So it's not as if one street has, you know, maybe it used to, but it's not as if one street has just one school. You know, they're all different because parents have different ideas on how their children should be educated and send them off to different schools with the belief that that school will be able to cater for their child's needs.
Not all parents have the option, and that is to say have an active home education group near where they live.
You'd be surprised.
Oh, really?
Yep, I'd say they're everywhere. I really would. And I mean, within Bristol, it's a very big community. People seem to think that if you home educate, you stay at home and educate your children, and you really don't. If anything, we're hardly ever at home.
But what about children who are growing up in small villages and things like that, maybe in Somerset, Gloucestershire? Surely they haven't got access to home education, have they?
They've got access to, everyone's got access to home education, but for them to meet within the big community might be a little bit harder, and then they might have to just, you know, whereas we have the option, being near Bristol, to see a vast amount of people, all ages, ranging from babies to adults, virtually every day of the week. But obviously, if you're in a small area, then yeah, I would say that would be harder, but you can travel.
So in a nutshell then, what is the difference between children being home educated and going off to a state school? What was the clincher for you?
Well, I spoke to the girls and I went for a job interview, and I did get the job interview. It was in Bath, and basically they said, you know, if you would like to talk to us, talk to us. Because it was a friend who got me the interview, and I really didn't put enough in it. And I spoke to the girls afterwards and I said, do you want me to leave you 8 o'clock in the morning so I can get into, you know, Bath for 9 o'clock, get Genevieve in a creche, and then be at work 9:30, finish at 5:30, get Genevieve from the creche that be in Bath, leave Bath at 6 o'clock, get home for, say, around 7:30. Hi, children, I'm your mum. Hi, Drew, I'm your mum. Now, a lot of people that do that are very strong people, and I really respect them. But for me personally, with Genevieve being 1 year old, no, I couldn't physically do that. And it was their choice. I said, do you want us to have a new car? Do you want the best clothes? Or would you rather go to secondhand shops? What is it you want? And they decided at that point in time that they wanted to be with me.
So how does it actually work? Do you have some sort of way of managing the curriculum and stuff with other mums?
I'm sure there are lots of mums that do, and I really don't mean to let home educators down by saying this, but I suppose I go for the more relaxed, autonomous, just let them do what they want, sort of lazy view, I suppose people would say. No, when I can see that they want to do something, I will help them strive and get the best that what they want to do.
Now, Martin Summers is joining me here as well, Old Labour, Oxford economist, because I know you've been involved in alternative education as well. What's your view of home education?
Well, to give me my background in relation to this, I used to work in the 80s in Kirkdale Free School in South London, which was not home education, but it was set up by parents in 1964 for similar reasons to the ones that you've mentioned. And it ran from 1964 till 1985, I believe. And I worked there in the early 80s. And it had pretty much the same kind of philosophy that's just been outlined, but as a group of people rather than as an individual. So, you know, the isolation of just being on your own was broken down. And, of course, the school did employ teachers, including myself, but we weren't paid very much, I have to say. But, of course, the philosophy was very similar.
So why did you decide to get into that rather than straight teaching at a state school?
I was fascinated by the ideas behind Kirkdale. It had been set up by Susie Powsland, who was a teacher, and she was actually a woodcraft folk leader as well. And a lot of the people who were involved in it had quite radical ideas about childcare.
The woodcraft folk are a sort of alternative to the scouts and the
guides,
aren't they?
Yeah, they were set up in the 1920s, I think, as an alternative to the scouts, because the scouts were felt to be too militaristic by some people. But lots of things that scouts did were obviously of interest, but they wanted to do the same things in mixed groups. You know, they do the same sort of things as scouts do, but with a less militaristic emphasis.
Back to you, Cherry. Can you give us an idea of what an average day is like for one of your children home educating? I mean, there probably isn't an average day, is there? But because I know they've actually come out of home education recently. But, you know, in a recent day for them, you know, how does it start, and how is the curriculum actually fitted in to what they do?
No curriculum is fitted into what they do. They haven't been to school for the last 4 years, and they've just started now at 13, and they've been put in the top of everything in the last 2 months. And they haven't been to school, followed any curriculum in the last 4 years, because they want to learn, because they want to get A stars, because they want to go to university. The teachers can see this, know that they want to learn. So, okay, we started Taekwondo January, but before Taekwondo, we'd get up at about, sometimes we'd be on the ice at 6 o'clock in the morning, ice skating for a few hours. Then we'd go home. If they wanted to do some English, we'd do some English. Or if they wanted to go outside and run around, we'd do that, depending on what it is they'd want to do. If one wanted to do some computer work, we'd go on the computer, you know. And where there are three of them, they have different ideas and different ways of doing. They, to be honest, they just really go off and do their own thing, and I tag around.
So do you have any kind of programme at all? I mean, because surely the way you're doing that, you're going to miss some subjects. They're just going to get missed out.
I think we probably missed out loads of subjects, but probably the majority of them, and I really don't mean to let Homer just down by saying this, but in all fairness, the last 4 years, we probably had a very relaxed attitude to education, but they have gone to school, started in year 9 now, and they're doing exceptionally well.
Now, have you had any problems with the authorities? They knock on your door and say, why aren't your children going to school?
No, but they do, so I must have been hiding from them, which I wasn't, because they were in a private school. Apparently you don't get fined, but if you're in a state school and you just walk out of a state school, obviously that's illegal, you can get fined, yada yada yada, but people don't know. They just have to write a simple letter saying I'm educating my child otherwise.
Are you saying that some parents take their children out of state schools without realising that actually they have every right to do that if they want to educate them at home?
Yeah, I've been told on numerous occasions that what I'm doing is illegal, and I tell them that, you know, I've been doing it for quite a few years and haven't been arrested yet, but I'd say, because when you're in a school, if you don't send your child to a school, you can get arrested, you can get fined, and you can go to prison. So people think that if you don't send your children to school, you are being illegal, and you're not. It's, as long as you, but because there are different rules and regulations, all you have to do is write a simple letter, you know, I'm educating my child otherwise. It is as simple as that, but if you don't know, like with a lot of things, you don't do it.
To what extent are you actually educating the children then alongside other children, or is it just simply in your own home?
Oh, no. We meet up at least 2 times a week, different areas in Bristol, groups of children in halls, and you have maths going on at one table, Latin on another table. If you want to, you can go another room, do drama. We've had productions up in Clifton, hired out halls up in Clifton, and they've been absolutely amazing. And if the child wants to, no matter what age they are, they can take part in that subject. And then when they get bored, they just get up and move to something else. Obviously say, I'm going to do something else now, which is fine, or they join in. But where we don't get people in, different parents with different abilities, there's a high number of teachers, very highly qualified parents that do come along with their children and participate and offer what skills they can, whether it be painting, making things, sewing, drama, any subject at all, Latin. Also, people's husbands have taken part making films, animation. They come in and show us things, or everybody knows someone else who can take part, and you know, in that sense.
So roughly in Bristol, roughly how many parents are educating their children like this then?
You have different groups as well, because you have the very religious groups that obviously we don't see, but then you have
some people take their children out of school for religious reasons.
I believe so. I haven't, so that's not me. But yes, I would say there are a lot of people that take their children out of school because they don't believe that their children at school are being educated along the religious side of things, but with their religious beliefs, or they don't believe the religious beliefs are right what they're teaching. But there are loads. The Bristol Home Education Group in Bristol is very big, and the people are all lovely. What I like about Home Ed is, I mean, because the girls did used to go to a state school, infants, and when you go into the playground, you have groups of parents that are stood together. You can walk through, they'll just ignore you. With the Home Edges Grace group, yes, you do have groups of people that talk, but everyone sticks together because everyone home educates. In the school, you don't get that. If there's a problem, we had in a case of bullying, so I approached before the parents and said, can I please talk to you? It was a total misunderstanding, but it could have gone very big. But in a school environment, if I'd approached 4 parents and said, can I talk to you please, afterwards my child would have got a lot of stick. If anything, the parents thanked me for bringing it to their attention, the children apologized to my child, and it was dropped and left at that point. Now in a school, you don't get that. Everyone knows. If you're too scared to say anything because you don't want the backlash, you don't want to get, you know, your child for being a grass or any trouble for your child for raising that to anyone's attention.
Martin, is there a bit of a problem, do you think, with this whole idea of people taking their children out of school for some sort of religious reason, or because they don't agree with what they're being taught?
I think in a free society, you can't stop people from educating their children as they see fit. But I think there's got to be some kind of oversight of that. Just think about what might happen with parents who are basically abusing their children and refusing to. I'm not saying that's the case here, but there's got to be some kind of oversight so that people know where people are, otherwise children could disappear, for example. But that's not the same thing as saying people shouldn't be able to educate at home. I think a lot of the flexibility that Cherry's looking for her children, that ought to be in the state system, but it isn't. because there's not enough resource to actually deal with children as individuals. One of the things we had at Kirkdale was we had an absolute golden rule that there should never be more than 8 children to an adult, ever. Mm. And of course, we managed to scrimp and save and duck and dive to allow that to happen. We'd have people coming in as volunteers and so on to try and make that happen. And because when you've got that low level of, or rather high level of pupil-teacher ratio, you can be much more flexible. You can just say, take your time, kids, learn as you'd like to learn. And that was the whole philosophy behind Kirkdale, is that we wanted to do exactly what you've been doing. Mm. But to do that, you've got to have plenty of adult input, otherwise it just falls apart. Well, that basically means resources. People say, well, we can't afford to have classes in state schools in Britain with one teacher to 8 pupils. And I say, well, we can't afford not to. Mm. This is the future. Let's scrap Trident, stop having foreign wars and start concentrating on what we really need to do. And that should start at an early age, at 3. You know, all of these things should be there for people and the flexibility should be there, and it isn't at the moment.
Isn't one of the problems that Martin, as someone has dealt with, this free school concept, which is probably even one step beyond the home education, that the children just don't get a sense for self-discipline?
That's not true at all. I think in actual fact, our kids used to go off at 13. It was fairly standard. They used to leave at 30. They come in at 3, ideally. Some used to come in later after they'd fallen foul of various other schools. But they used to leave at 13, and all the local schools in Lewisham where we were based, they used to love getting our kids because our kids were so much more mature than the normal kids they were getting. They were already motivated, they knew what they wanted to do. Most of them went on to make a great success of their lives, even the non-academic ones. They were good at things like building and very self-confident about that.
So are you saying that the state system mitigates against that confidence, self-confidence?
The state system struggles with lack of resources. I mean, basically, a lot of children end up in schools with no home background backup at all. Never mind parents who teach their kids Latin, barely teach them to speak English. Those kind of children are a kind of grit in the system, and there needs to be a lot of resource put in if you're going to look after people properly. If we had the imagination of what we really wanted, what we should think is, what do we want our schools to look like, and then work backwards to how much it was going to cost, rather than saying this is all we can afford and this is what we're going to get. And I think the national curriculum and all of the kind of grad grind approach of the last generation has really made schools even more of factories than they used to be. Everybody's terrified of their test results and their scores and so on. And, the English primary school was at one stage quite a flexible institution, and it's become less so.
Now, Sherry, you were saying that your children have been out of formal education anyway, and being home educated for 4 years. Mm-hmm. So how have they fitted back in now they're back in education?
Okay.
And what kind of school are they in? Whereabouts are they?
They're in Peel, in a comprehensive school in St Catharines. Lovely school. The teachers have been really good. I go in virtually every day. They've been really patient with me. The girls, when they first went in, the eldest twin just basically laughed because she knows she can walk through, she can do all the work, no problem at all. The other one used to come home in tears. It's only been a few weeks, because when she goes into the class, she doesn't understand why the teachers are unable to communicate with the children. They just shout, right, you're going to get detention if you don't do this, you're going to get detention, sit down, get your books out, yada, yada, yada. And she was coming home distressed about the fact, not that they were saying anything to her in general, but with the other children. And then, of course, when you get the next class, they could see why some of the children were being, their words, being misunderstood by the other teachers, because they'd been wound up in the first class. They haven't been able to relax and enjoy what it was they were supposed to be doing.
Well, don't you think they've been a bit mollycoddled, sort of just doing what they want for the last 4 years?
What, my girls? Oh, of course. They have. And they do need to, because they are going to go out in the workforce and meet a vast range of people, but they're not just going to be sat with a very small group of children that are their age. They're going to be with a versatile range of people, and they are, not going to be shouted at to get things. And hopefully people will, through how they've been brought up, they will be able to communicate with people a lot more responsible than some school children.
So as they're growing up, now I know you're biased because you're their mum, but how do you see that they're, already a little bit different to ordinary state educated children?
I could ask you the same question. My girls, how would you feel about, how would you
answer? Well, they seem pretty confident and outgoing.
I think they are very confident, very outgoing, and I strongly believe that's because they've been able to communicate with me, and I've been there for them a lot more than I possibly could have been.
Do you think it's to do with this whole thing of telling the children what to do, or else encouraging the children to do what they want to do?
I've tried telling them, they don't listen. I've tried shouting, screaming, jumping on them. Not really jumping. It doesn't work. Well, for me, it hasn't, personally. We have to talk things through and decide what's best for all of us, otherwise it just doesn't work. And hopefully their life skills as well are going to be a lot more, hopefully they'll be able to look after themselves. Like, for example, a couple of years ago I wasn't well and I was led in bed for 2 days. Genevieve was about 2.5 years old. They kept house for 2 days and looked after me, which was awesome. Whereas a lot of other children I know that are their age and have been in schools don't seem to be able to look after things on a grander scale than just coping with themselves.
Martin, do you think we're looking at something a bit bigger here than just home education? Because it seems like some of these children are actually a lot more confident and a lot, you know, at a younger age than ordinary state-educated children, who are sort of told to sit in line and are subjected to quite a lot more discipline.
There's actually a spectrum here of different approaches. You've got home education, you've got alternative education, like I was involved in. Then you've got experimental state schools. And at one stage, we were negotiating about our school being part of the Inner London Education Authority and being open to everybody. There's a whole spectrum of schools, state schools, private schools, what have you. What I think we need is to actually look at children as children, the whole thing of child-centred education. What do children actually need? And one of the things that's been lacking in this country, for example, is, which you've got in Scandinavia, is universal nursery education, where they play. They don't try and teach them stuff. They play.
Till they're seven.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. And I think a lot of home educators are of this philosophy.
Yeah.
And, of course, that philosophy actually chimes quite a lot with progressive teachers' philosophy. But, of course, some people taking their children out of school are not taking them out of school to give them more freedom. They're often taking them out of school to give them less. And there is a bit of a problem with that. There's got to be a basic standard. Children have rights. I firmly believe that. And I'm sure that Cherry does too. Some parents don't believe that children have rights, and therefore the rights of the children have to be protected from those of the parents to an extent. Parents also have their rights. But we can't just write a blank cheque for parents to do what they want with their children.
People might not even know that they have the choice.
But I mean, I don't see any problem with people educating at home. What I would like to see is the state system properly funded and flexible enough so that it's actually quite, it wouldn't be such a big leap from one thing to the other. The state schools should be more like home education.
Martin, do you think that there are some children in state education who are seen as real problem children that could be educated better in a free school or
absolutely
in home education?
I mean, one of the things we were arguing when we were talking with the ILEA about funding our project in the 80s was that we were prepared to take a proportion of kids who are having difficulties in other schools, the ones that nobody else wanted. But we didn't want to be a sin bin. Yeah?
Yeah.
What we wanted to be was a centre of excellence for children of all abilities. So we would have some very bright kids with lots of dynamism and ambition, and we'd have other kids who are damaged and problematic. But we would have them in certain proportions where it was feasible for us to deal with all of the children as individuals and bring out the best in all of them. And that was what the aspiration was. One of the things we were able to do was have mixed ability teaching, which worked, even in small groups, because the cleverer ones teach the slower ones.
Yeah.
And the slower ones like being taught by the cleverer ones if they're all chums, and it's not actually an issue. And actually the cleverer ones teaching the slower ones is actually a bit of an intellectual challenge for them. They understand it. Can they explain it?
But not necessarily some children are cleverer than other children. I mean, I've met children before that home ed, 8 years old, that chose not to read and write. Now, in a school environment, your class is stupid, you're put in a thick class. In the home ed, you know, home ed environment, right, okay, let's find a magazine that you like to read that will get you into that. And I've seen these children now a few years later that speak fluently in Chinese, that write in Chinese, but in a school that they're not given that opportunity.
We underestimate what all children are capable of at all abilities. Yeah, that's another thing that happens, is we're cramming everybody through one sausage machine. That's actually bad for all kinds of people that don't fit that formula. One kid we had, Billy, he went through the whole school, his whole school career. He came at 3 and left at 15, I think, and he didn't learn to read and write the whole time. Then, what he loved doing, he was always up a tree or building something. He set himself up in business as a builder, and then, of course, he had to do his books. And, you know, within 6 months, he taught himself to read and do maths, because he needed to do that to do his books. He actually became extremely, extremely wealthy as a result of his entrepreneurial skills, what have you.
But it's not good enough saying that, oh, well, kids can just opt out of learning to read and write, Martin.
Listen, that's an extreme case. most of the kids, our kids actually, went to the state schools and they read and write better than most of the other kids. That's because their parents were highly literate, artistic-y people. This is the real problem with our system, is that some kids don't get anything at home and they don't get much out of school either, and then they don't get much out of life. And we must gear our efforts to look after those kids, and the schools have to be flexible to deal with those kids. My sister teaches in a unit for kids that have been kicked out of schools in Cheltenham. And of course the philosophy of the unit is very similar to your philosophy. But of course there has to be a bit of tough love. They're not allowed to break the place up, punch each other or whatever. There's got to be some boundaries. But nevertheless, the whole thing is geared around them and their needs rather than making them fit what somebody else thinks they ought to be doing. And there needs to be plenty of scope for those kind of experiments to take place.
Cherry, surely it's just silly to suggest that children could teach other children. They need an adult, really, don't they, to teach them things?
No, I'd say the twins probably taught Genevieve to read and write. Okay, I'm there too, don't get me wrong. I'm not, you know, sat down having a pint watching EastEnders or something. We don't even have a telly in the house. But they do. They've taught Genevieve probably a lot more than what I have, because they're nearer to her age. They're nearer to her different abilities. And also one thing I have to say about learning as well, with Genevieve, she likes to do writing at 7 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the evening. Now that's when she wants to do it. If I try and push her into do it at a different time, it doesn't work, and we just end up arguing. It really doesn't work. It has to be when she wants to do it. It really does. And with the twins, fortunately, sometimes they'll see that she's picking up a book if I've missed it or something, or they'll start talking or about their day. And if they see an opportunity, they get it. And Genevieve picks all of it up from them.
Couldn't this sort of attitude be quite problematic when the children eventually come to get a job? The boss will say, OK, it's time to do this. And they'll say, actually, no, it's not time to do that. I'm going to do something else.
Yeah, well, maybe they'll end up with his job then. But that could be a case. But hopefully they'll be able to discuss it with the person in question, or they'll say, yeah, you know, and they'll get their work done. And after they've got their work done, they could turn around and say, yeah, you know, but we could have taken things at a different view. Or
you asked me earlier why I got interested in alternative education when I left university, and it's precisely because I felt that schools were not educating young people for participation in a democracy. The schools were, in fact, a factory model, and that what they were doing was turning out factory fodder. Now, that is not the purpose of education. The purpose of education is to find the unique spirit in every individual. And, of course, if we're thinking about the kind of economy we're moving into, where people are going to have to learn new skills just like that, think laterally, work in teams, be able to persuade others rather than bully them. All of these things should be learned in school. The schools should reflect the kind of society we want to see at the end of it, which is a participatory society, where people's views are listened to, where everybody is given a voice.
Is it only fairly well-to-do families that can afford to actually have their children home educated?
I'm a complete peasant. What are you on about? No, not at all, not at all. But yes, we did have tutors, and yes, they can be costly. But at the same time, look at the universities, look at clubs that you go to. We know someone who's just finished a science degree, and for a very small fee, she'll teach the girls for an hour or two. But then again, we have school teachers that are tutors as well for them. We have gone through that stage. Yes,
but for many families,
it doesn't have to be costly.
For many families, they just simply don't have any spare money to educate their children. There's no way they could think about doing anything else than the state system.
It doesn't have to be. When we meet up twice a week, it's about £3 or £5 for the whole family. And you have so many opportunities to meet different people that will help you. And that's the thing. If there is someone, you know, I mean, the lovely lady Kate who teaches the Latin, she will give her free time and sit there. And she thoroughly enjoys it as well, because she's obviously teaching herself and making sure that she's learnt different things. I think she's studying Latin as well. But everyone seems to chip in. Everyone seems to share. And no one minds sharing. Everyone wants to share.
When I worked in the free school, we were paid very, very poorly. Very poorly, but of course we were all dedicated and committed to the ideals behind the school. But there can be tension there. There can be tension, and there was tension between me and the management committee of the school in the end, because I wanted some funding so that we could pay some reasonable wages, and people would rather be independent, which actually meant being bankrupt in the end. People have got to be realistic about money.
You've got that in the home ed as well, actually, where some people want to ask different organisations, ask different charities, if we can have money so that we can maybe do this and this. I don't know, milk a yak somewhere or something in a foreign country. But there's a lot of people that know we don't want to do that, because if we do that, we will become dependent on that.
Yeah.
As a group, you know, so there are different things, yeah. But everyone does sit down.
I think when somebody's doing something for you for free, you should say, great, fantastic. Yeah. But it should be absolutely clear what's happening.
Mm.
Yeah. But make sure that you realise that, you know, the opportunity cost of that, I did a degree in economics, the opportunity cost of that lady working for free for an hour, she could earn £25 doing
but
it.
But she chooses to do that.
Sure, that's right. So she, at the minimum, she's contributing £25. You see what I mean?
At least,
yeah.
And she does drama as well.
A lot more.
And she will sit and write scripts for drama.
To be honest with you, I loved working with kids in this way. It was actually pleasurable. And I was prepared to take a pay cut to do it. But that's got to be absolutely clear that everybody understands that's what's going on.
Okay, so if anyone's interested in meeting parents who are home educating their children in Bristol,
get online, and then you just type Bristol Home Education, and then you have a few people's email addresses, and you contact those. They'll meet up and talk to you, and it's fantastic. Really good way of getting to meet people.
Isn't there a network called Education Otherwise?
There's a that is a brilliant Education Otherwise. Get in contact with them. They're amazing. Any questions you have about school, they will even send you a template letter to send to the school, and you just have to print and sign it. Really amazing organisation. To join that, it's like £20 a year or something, but you haven't got to join. You can just go online and read about them and... Yeah, really, really good organisation, Education Otherwise.
Wrapping up, both of you, what do you think are the main reasons why a child might just not fit into the state system? Do you want to go first, Martin?
Because the state system is a one-size-fits-all system, inevitably. There's not enough teachers to deal with the individual needs of individual children. And I think the state system is actually fails many of our children, not just a minority, especially those that are not terribly academic. And we need to actually have a better state system. That would be my ultimate goal. And the state system needs a bit of competition from home educators to go in the right direction.
Every child's different. Also, there should be more of a versatile range of schools. I mean, it'd be nice to have some Montessori. If there's Montessori schools, which Genevieve could go in, she'd go now.
What's that?
Oh, Maria Montessori had... really good view and belief that when children were certain ages, they had certain windows in their life when they could learn and be more receptive to different things. And her way of schooling, just to me, I would love that. I would send Genevieve now if there was one, but there isn't one for her age group in Bristol. I think the nearest one's Oxford. It's just a completely different view to state school, where one size fits all. This is more for the individual child.
We need to get back to child-centred philosophy of education, which used to underpin the Plowden report into primary education in the 60s. They tried to move state schools in this direction, and of course it's all been closed down with the national curriculum and all of this one size fits all. You're all going to be working in factories, you've got to learn to do as you're told. That's all rubbish. I mean, genuine progressive educators have always had the same ideals, and they're fulfilled in different ways.
Martin, one of the big changes recently in the last few years has been the academies, which is essentially a kind of privatisation of schools. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, we've got this whole free school potential for free schools to be set up now by the new coalition government. But of course the problem with that is that they're taking money from the state to set these schools up, and of course the question is, where is that money going to come from? Is it going to come from bog standard comprehensive down the road, where the kids are already struggling with lack of resources? So that, you know, we've got to be very careful that there's fairness in the allocation of resources, especially when society is so unfair to some people. And I'm all in favour of progressive education, but it can't be some children at the expense of others. There's got to be some fairness in it.
I don't like the academies at all. I don't understand why businesses want to buy into the schools. I also don't like the thumbprinting idea.
What's that?
Oh, they've got it in Western Supermare. You go in to get your lunch, and apparently this is to stop bullying. Okay. You go in to get your lunch and you have your thumb scanned, okay? Your face comes up with who you are, and then that pays for your lunch. If you don't eat properly within 3 days, you get a letter home to your family telling them you're not eating properly. Apparently this is to stop bullying. I don't understand why it won't bring in a new type of bully, but there you go. All your details are on this. I just don't like the idea of my children going in, having their thumb scanned, and then their face,
Yeah, no.
But you might also find that there's more children being home educated in Western since this fingerprint
thing
came in.
I think a lot of people think that because it's done in a school, it has to be right and we have to follow where they were sheep themselves without even realising.
I mean, Ivan Illich wrote a book called Deschooling Society in the 1970s, and he's pointing out how society itself, because it's been schooled, is then rigid and inflexible in its approach to social problems. And that's because everybody's been to school and learned how to think badly. Now, I think we need to reform rather than abolish the school system, but I think that there's lots of room for positive changes.
That was Sherry Townsend there talking recently to Martin Summers and I all about home education. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is time for the Sky News at 7. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That's Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows, and to reporters Marina Morris and our resident Old Labour economist, Martin Summers. Next week, leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland, will have her car fixed, which broke down on the way here last week, and be here to help us navigate our way through the week's news all over again. That's enough talk for tonight, because Friday night is music night. Coming up at 8 o'clock, it's Dan and Matt's Erotic Toast Project, and at 9, Permission to Dance with Josh and James. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in